Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Haiti is one of the poorest nations in the world, and while that is not exactly news, what you might be unaware of is that the Haitian government is refusing to process most travel documents from the U.S. until further notice because the U.S. has ordered more than 30,000 Haitians to leave America, but Haiti says it can't handle the influx of people because the already poor country was ravaged by several major storms last year and is still rebuilding. In the midst of this chaos, five brave women hold up their heads to not only survive, but to insist that their rights and the rights of other workers be respected. Their story is told in the documentary Poto Miton, I hope I pronounced it correctly, which was screened at MTSU on February 16th. And with us to talk about the movie and the Haitian situation are two of the filmmakers, Renee Bergen and Mark Schuller. Welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Was that fairly close, Poto Miton?
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Okay. Let's get specific first about these women and how they live on a day-to-day basis so we can, like, flesh out the dry governmental statistics and politics of Haiti. And let me see if I can pronounce their names correctly. Solange, mm-hmm. Frisline, Thérèse, mm-hmm. Marie-Jean, mm-hmm. and Hélène. What are their lives like?
Well, they're all working class women in Haiti. They're of part of Haiti's poor majority. 80% of Haiti's people make under $2 a day, U.S. They certainly are all among that. All of them at a certain time were factory workers. So they make Haiti's minimum wage or near it, 70 goud a day or... Currently, it's about $1.75 U.S. per day. All of them were born outside of Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti, and all of them, for different reasons, one or another, came to Port-au-Prince to find work, or because they were pushed out because of agricultural policies that starved peasants off their land. And so they live in places that you may see in the newspapers. Place called Solange lives in Cité Soleil, Haiti's largest shanty town. About 300,000 people live in a very, very, very small part of Haiti, a slum north of the capital, literally built on top of garbage. Other women live in other neighborhoods similar to that, not as big or as bad necessarily. None of them have running water, for example. Electricity is intermittent at best. Most of the four women that came there since the 80s live in places that are about 7 feet by 8 feet. And some as much as seven people live in those houses. Tin roofs, cinder block houses, so it's very hot. Haiti's in the Caribbean. It's a tropical island, so... It gets extremely hot during the summers there. So as far as the rest of their, you know, lives, they each have a different story. They each have a different thing that makes them unique, and they each have a different wisdom or analysis or experience that they want to share with people.
What kind of factory work did they do? What did they make?
Right. Haiti was part of the Caribbean based initiative of Ronald Reagan to do primarily textiles, clothing, particularly jeans and shirts, undershirts, things that are relatively simple construction. So
are these clothes would end up in American retail outlets, some of them?
Yes. Some of the brands you might be familiar with, like Hanes, like Fruit of the Loom, like Levi's. Those kinds of Disney had an operation there until shamed out of it by another documentary. They pulled out their, they canceled their contracts. But mm-hmm. companies you've heard of. So,
do they have families, children, husbands?
Half of them have. Well, they each have a different family situation. One of them is a divorcee. One of them never married. One of them is a widow. Two of them are married. One of them is too young to have been married yet. So,
Renee, how did they become involved in grassroots political activism?
How did they become involved?
Yeah.
Actually, that's more of a Mark question.
Okay.
So sorry.
That's all right. We'll get back to you later.
The Division of Labor, I was the one who was asked to make this film. Mm-hmm. They are part of a grassroots organization of women workers. It's part of a women's organization that sponsors health care, education, training for them. And then they had a committee, a women's committee, where they met once a month to debate issues in the factory. In the factories where they work, they discuss common problems, they come up with common solutions to those problems, and brainstorm strategy. That's what they used to do on a monthly basis. They had several campaigns to get the government to raise the minimum wage, to get the government to...
Which they were successful at, by the way.
They were successful at the increase in minimum wage under President Aristide in 2003. They were also successful at getting the... what you could call the workers' comp office and Social Security to enforce the laws that factory owners are supposed to pay into their accounts, and they can draw from that if they have a medical emergency. So they were successful at that. Those kinds of issues. They're not a union. They're not from the same factory, so they were able to speak more freely because the boss isn't around. They had a level of trust. They're leaders in their neighborhoods. They do sort of civic education. They, information. They have a journal that they publish.
They have a creative journal.
In Creole, in the language of Haiti's majority.
And the journal is about workers' rights. So allowing other women, well, not just solely about that, but allowing other women to understand their rights as workers, because if they don't know their rights, then they won't do anything if they're being, mistreated. Mm-hmm. But they also give information on,
women's health issues like HIV/AIDS, like prevention, mm-hmm. like
preventative,
those kinds of hygiene, clean water, how to boil it. What are the consequences?
What is the difference between the Committee to Defend Working Women's Rights and Women in Action? Two separate groups that I read about on the website for the movie.
Yeah, the Women in Action is a group that one of the women, Hélène, was co-founder of after her experience with the Women's Committee, just a way of shortening, the Women's Committee to Defend Workers' Rights. That was through this women's organization. Since then, in 2006, Hélène co-founded Women in Action, which was a smaller grassroots group that worked on other, similar issues, but it more of a grassroots neighborhood focus than a health, women's health focus.
Renee, how did you become connected with the project? What intrigued you about it?
Well, actually, Mark was down there, as he mentioned, doing his PhD work, and he was studying on two female NGOs, non-government organizations, and the film actually was started by the request of the women. Mark said, how can I thank you, or how can I repay you for the time that you've given me, all this time for my questions and interviews, and they said, well, we think it's great that you're writing about us, but we don't think very many people are going to read about it. Mm-hmm. So if you really want people to know our story, you should make a documentary about us. And so Mark came back to Santa Barbara, which is where we were living at the time, mm-hmm. and he went to UC Santa Barbara's Film Studies Department, where I'm an alumni from, and asked them who they would suggest. And I had just a few years earlier done a documentary about women in Haiti. I'm sorry, excuse me, women in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And so without, I guess, any hesitation, they suggested he talk to me. So that was around 2004, 2005. I was just wrapping up another film. We talked for a while, and then our first trip down there was in 2006, August. So I'm kind of the technical or the filmmaking end of, the film. And so we come from two different sides, but it's worked out to be very, balanced approach.
Not having seen the film, what mm-hmm. kind of an approach did you take? Do you have narration? Do you just let the women tell it themselves without narration? What did you decide to do?
We went down in August and we just did preliminary interviews with the women, partially to see which women we would focus on. We had about eight or so women that we could choose from, and because we want to keep the film at about 50 minutes, we knew we couldn't have all of them be in it. So we chose about five women. We did choose five women to follow. And then after the initial research trip, we got back the transcripts and we brainstormed about which would be the best approach, to more on a thematic angle about how we're talking about the issues that the women present, or do it more as character-driven through the women's lives. So we chose to do the character-driven, but in truth, it's kind of character-driven and thematically driven at the same time, because what we chose to do was each woman kind of represents a part of Haiti's issues, whether it's the lack of education, violence, the effects of globalization, you know, the high cost of living. All of them have similar stories, such as, you know, they're living in working conditions, but then also they have separate stories. So we chose to go by telling the film, telling the issues through the women, and then connecting the stories are little short stories, short narratives called cric-cracs. And cric-crac in the Haiti's culture is basically short stories where you have somebody tell a story to an audience. And we chose a piece that was written by Edwidge Danticat and edited a little bit, and she actually does the narration in the film. And while she's narrating these pieces, all of the pieces we kind of tailored a little bit to kind of reflect the next woman's story. And the visuals that you see are of a woman braiding her daughter's hair, but it's in a very kind of dreamlike way. It's blurry, it's out of focus, a lot of close-ups to kind of keep we wanted it to be a metaphor of how it could represent any, you know, most Haitian women. So it is a literal and a metaphorical weaving of the stories, both within the film and within their society.
How much time did you spend shooting the film?
I went down four times. Mark went down a few additional times without me and used a couple people on the ground there, crew members for a shoot here or a shoot there. In total, we have almost 80 hours of footage.
And in post-production, how long did it take you?
It was very off and on post-production, so it's really difficult for me to say that, but I would say probably about 3 months solid at least, if not a little bit more, maybe four. But we were, you know, the post-production was interrupted by me moving across the country, by grant writing, by the trips, by other work. When I first started working on this, I was also doing other work to kind of supplement my income, because documentaries don't pay a stellar amount. So, yeah, I mean, overall, the project took 2.5 years from start to finish.
When you were shooting in Haiti, did you encounter any obstacles, either logistical, environmental, governmental?
Yes. Every time we went down there, I mean, we had to coordinate our trips mostly around Mark's teaching schedule, which didn't allow for us to really kind of choose the time frame that we wanted to come down. And unfortunately, sometimes, like our second trip that we came down, and we expected that to be kind of our main trip, was a very difficult time in that the insecurity situation was high level. So we actually couldn't do as much shooting. We even lost one of our women during that time. Mark had gone to visit her without me, just to talk to her, try to set up an interview. And when he left, her neighbors came to her house and said, you know, where's the money, where's the money, where's the money the blanc gave you? And the blanc is a term for foreigner. And she said, he didn't give me any money. Oh, well, he must have given you money. Why else would he be seeing you? And so she was really freaked out, which I totally understand. And she said, I can't do any more interviews with you. So she actually, we only was able to do one interview with her, which was the first kind of research trip interview. We had to really negotiate where we interviewed the women, not so much for our safety, but for their safety and for their to give them less hassle, you know. One woman, Solange, that he mentioned, who we had to hire somebody to go shoot her in her environment, because it just went, it would draw too much attention to have white people coming to her house. Yeah. So he's of Haitian, you know, he's Haitian, so he went and did the shooting at her house. So we had to, you know, we had to take a lot of this into consideration in terms of their safety. As far as us, we had a couple, we did have people that kind of played with us. you know, wouldn't tell us no, but would just toy with us. You know, we showed up to one place three or four times to do an interview, and every time we did, they said, you know, sorry, that person's not here. It was just their way of not saying no, but giving us every hint of no.
Yeah.
Or when we went to a free trade zone in the northeast part of Haiti to do, to actually try to get into a factory, and we were told we could, and we drove, gosh, over 12 hours on really bumpy Haitian roads and came there and was told, oh, there's no interview set up, blah, 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 you know, oh, that person never comes in on this day. And we're like, we just drove an entire day to get here. I'm sorry, why don't you come back next week? Because we're leaving the country. So there was that kind of, you know, stuff happening as well.
Mark, was there any difficulty getting U.S., with the U.S. State Department or anything, getting permission to go to Haiti for any reason?
Well, I mean, that's a... It's an interesting question. The U.S. State Department doesn't want U.S. citizens to be there, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, most of the period of my dissertation research, there was a quote-unquote ordered departure, so I was actually there against the advice of the U.S. government. Frankly, a lot of the, if you look at the information, it's the same warning, travel warning since 2002, and the situation changes a lot, so it's just a scare, in my opinion, it's a scare tactic to keep people away from Haiti. Of course, people do what they want, you know, it's their way of saying, if you get in trouble, we're not responsible, you know.
It's more a liability issue, right?
Right, I mean, if you were
the lawyers tell them to put that
right,
in
as
there.
A graduate student, the university, I had to sign a thing with the university saying, yes, I know there's a warning, and I'm not going to sue, my family's not going to sue should I come back. Mangled or whatever.
Dismembered.
You know, it's. I mean, the Haitian people are not the kind of like scary boogeymen that we see in the U.S. Of course, when there's a riot happening or a very, you know, tense political moment, there's violence, and you focus on that. Like, you know, the CNN, they're there. They take the image and they leave. I mean, so the only image we get of Haiti is that violence. The people that were filming. The coup d'etat in 2004 were fresh from Iraq. I mean, they were looking for blood. And they were, you know, and they found it. I mean, I'm not saying it wasn't there, but it's not at all the vast majority of Haiti. Most Americans in Haiti don't know what people live, how people survive is through cooperating with one another, through supporting one another, through sharing, through really collectivist traditions that, frankly, people in the U.S. can learn from. But
they really don't have any choice, do they, but to work together.
Sure. I mean, that's absolutely true, but they do choose to help one another. I've been several places, and someone, a neighbor or a fellow church member or a friend or a family member has just dropped by and said, here's a plate of rice, I'm just making sure you don't go to bed hungry tonight, you know, and there's just like, you don't see any of that if you're just hiding in your... you know, protected, you know, chauffeured existence. And so, of course, the U.S. government doesn't know about it because they're not on the ground. And that's the unfortunate reality. That's who's setting policy. Mm-hmm. People at development agencies, some of them actually said, you know, they would have liked to have gotten to know Haiti better, but they were told not to because, you know, there was a kidnapping scare, et cetera. So, I mean, unfortunate. I mean, I didn't see that as a real barrier because I actually knew the terrain better than the people writing that that warning, frankly, because I don't even know that it's been updated. Yeah. And the situation's changed six or seven times.
Well, you alluded to it, that the U.S. gives scant attention, especially in the media, to Latin America in general, with the exception of the occasional slam on the Chavez regime in Venezuela.
Sure.
So given the economic troubles in the U.S. at the moment, what do you think is the likelihood that the Obama administration will be any more attentive to Haiti than prior American administrations?
Well, his chief is, one of his political advisors is a Haitian-American. They met each other from Chicago. So there's some West Wing Haitian-American presence. So there's some hope there. Having a foreign policy that's more geared towards, you know, working with the UN and the world community as opposed to imposing a unilateral, you know, militaristic disaster capitalism. On the other hand, I mean, it means that there's going to be more openness. Whether there's going to be more aid dollars, frankly, I don't expect there to be more aid dollars. I expect there to be less. But if it could be spent better with grassroots you know, support, and with actually listening to what the Haitian people demand as, you know, define as their priorities, I think there could be actually a lot more good that we could be doing. There's a network of people working right now to, you know, to draft alternatives to our foreign development policies. The Oxfam and several other NGOs are working right now to seize this political opportunity that we have. Debt cancellation, we were this close before the financial crisis hit. So there's some momentum that people here in the Solidarity community are seizing upon and talking to one another and sharing ideas and sharing white papers, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and there is some hope that there's going to be some change.
Renee, did these women who are the focus of the documentary, did they say anything about any retribution that might have been exacted on them, physical or otherwise, because of their political activism?
Not that I'm aware of.
Did they feel fairly free to speak their minds?
We before Renee even got there, I had three meetings with them to say, okay, if you really want this, you know, here's some risks that can be associated. First, you could lose your job. As late as 1994, people were being killed for their just having a photo of President Aristide in their bedroom. I mean, their room, because it was a one-room house. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, you know, people do remember that. So they were fully cognizant of those risks, and a lot of them took, you know, made enormous personal sacrifice to make sure this movie happened. And they were, you know, every time we talked about the risk, they're like, yes, we understand, you know. We totally understand. This is why we wanted, you know, this is why we want to make this movie.
One in particular, I mean, we gave her a spy camera purse because we were actually not able to get into the factories in the end. But we actually did this very early on. We gave the women disposable still cameras, and then we moved into digital still cameras, and then eventually we acquired a spy camera purse. Mm-hmm. So that there's a lens on the purse, and we just put a little small video recorder inside, and she walked in and did some footage. And you can clearly see what that is. That's the black and white footage in the film. So
this is to document the sweatshop conditions.
Document the conditions inside. And we were lucky because we had an unknown window. Our last trip that we went back in, I actually was kind of asking her for some really specific imagery that she had mentioned, and she said, well, we can't bring purses in anymore. So we were very lucky that we had that opportunity.
They got wise to it somehow.
Not with us.
Must have gotten wise to it with somebody.
No. Some factories would not allow purses, and this was one that would.
The reason why they didn't want to is because they didn't want people to bring things to sell, because that would say to people that they're not making enough money working minimum wage in Haiti, which they weren't. So that was one of the reasons why they were clamping down at that particular factory at that time. Because it was saying that you're too poor,
right,
essentially. So that was why. So.
But at the factory that we were not allowed to go into and had traveled this long distance, there was a union that was allowed, what permissed to bring in cameras and whatnot and take video or pictures at liberty. So we asked one of those workers if they would do it. And again, you know, we checked with them a million times. Are you sure this is okay? You sure this is okay? Oh, yeah, we do it all the time. But the timing of our presence and their doing the work, the factory owners did put two and two together. And the person almost got fired, but thankfully they did not. It was a little scary.
It was a lot scary.
It's obvious from hearing the two of you talk, you're very cognizant of and very respectful of and caring about what happens to these women as a result of their cooperation with you.
Well, again, it's their movie. I mean, but yes, we did a lot of the work and we made the decisions about the editing and whatnot, but this film would not exist without the request. And Mark goes down several times a year, so every time he would go down, he would show them a rough cut, ask them their opinions if there was anything that they didn't want in it or they did. And so, you know, we listened to them. So they were involved in it.
Talk a little bit about the distribution of the film. How are you getting it shown?
We're just starting that process right now. We literally just finished the film on January 9th. It had its premiere January 23rd at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival. And So currently we are looking for distributors, and we're also submitting it to film festivals. Distributors take their time. It'll take 1 or 2 months before we hear back, and then we have to negotiate, you know, what percentage and whatnot. We're mostly looking at educational distributors. So, yeah, so that's how it's working.
did you pay for it with grants? Did you apply for grants to help fund?
We certainly applied for grants.
We applied for so many grants. It's ridiculous.
But we got $4,000. I got $4,000 from the Labor and Employment Research Grant at the University of California while I was a graduate student. Mm-hmm. The rest of it was individuals.
This is very grassroots.
We have about 130 individual project. Donors for the film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And several people actually pre-ordered it, so that was a way that we stayed afloat. So,
you have to get very creative about your fundraising now. So luckily we had a couple large donors, one who even gave us a matching grant, so therefore guaranteeing that we would make a certain amount. But we've done everything from just email campaigns to performances to wine tastings and dinners to a contest to pre-sales. The end was pre-sales. We were able to really get in some money on the, you know, the latter part. With pre-sales, educational pre-sales.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you ended up on HBO?
That would be great.
That would, like, you know, that's where a lot of documentaries go these days, is to some cable outlet.
POV, PBS, yeah. But that's also very highly, highly competitive.
Right.
So,
there have been a couple of developments on the global stage. The International Monetary Fund has increased lending to Haiti by $36.6 million, and the Swiss government, that's dollars, and the Swiss government is trying to get 7 million Swiss francs, or about $6 million, in reportedly ill-gotten gains seized from bank accounts linked to Baby Doc Duvalier, Haiti's former dictator. What do you think, Mark, is the chance that people like these women will ever see any of the kind of money filter down to their level and help them?
Well, I mean, the first step is obviously what we can do in the North, in the U.S. and Europe, is to release Haiti from its chain of debt. $1.7 billion translates to about $1 million a week that's being sent in debt service to the World Bank, to the IMF, to the International Inter-American Development Fund. So right there, so will it ever reach the grassroots level, in maybe in direct ways? I mean, if that $1 million a week could be spent in education or roads or healthcare, it would definitely be a benefit to the women in the film. And without the debt enslaving Haitian government, then I do believe that Haiti's civil society is strong enough to be able to push the Haitian government into actually keeping those promises, free education and healthcare and, you know, national production of, you know, agriculture. So,
the name of the movie is Potomitan, Haitian Women, Pillars of the Global Economy. Go to www.potomitan.net. That's POTOMITAN, the filmmakers. Co-producers are Renee Bergen and Mark Schuller, who have been talking with us here today on MTSU on the Record. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.